Good. So my name is Brian Chouvet, and I'm going to be giving the lectures for the Explorations in Particle Theory class. So the point of this class is to look at some current research topics in particle physics. And in particular, we're going to be looking at the role of particle physics in resolving certain issues in cosmology. So you'll probably have heard about some of these things in prior cosmology classes or if you're doing research in that area, but we're going to take a particle physics approach to it. So because there are few enough of us here, I really don't want to be talking about things that aren't interesting to you. So if you find that I'm going too quickly or I'm going too slowly or there are some topics that you really want to hear about, just let me know and I can easily adapt to that because we want to make sure that everyone's getting the most out of this that they can. So here's my email address and my office, so feel free to drop by whenever. Okay. Today's lecture, we're going to give an introduction to dark matter, and first I'm going to start by motivating some of the things that we're interested in looking at for the course. So we can look at the current state of our understanding of the content of the universe by drawing a pie chart, where we look at the relative abundances of different things. So we have some very large piece, which is dark energy. This, we know, is about 68% of the universe's energy. Then we have something which we're going to call dark matter, which comprises about 27%. And then the rest, this tiny little sliver here, is baryonic matter, along with things like photons, et cetera. But it's mostly made up of baryons, and this is going to be about 5%. So first of all, what's interesting is that everything that we know about particle physics in terms of the standard model of particle physics is completely captured in just this 5% here. So there's a lot going on that we don't understand. And so this leads to several questions that we can ask. So for the purpose of this, I'm mostly going to ignore the question of dark energy. This can be well described by just a cosmological constant if you're willing to accept fine-tuning. And you might learn more about that in some other courses, but from the perspective of particle physics, we don't really have a lot to say about that. But we can ask questions about the other parts. So first of all, we can ask, what is dark matter? So it seems to be something that's not described by any of the current particles or interactions that we know about. So can we incorporate it into the standard model? So can we take our current particle physics theory, which is performing very well in a lot of experiments, and extend it in a way that can explain this chunk of the pie without messing up everything else that we know about? And also, we want to understand how can we determine its properties. So we know that it's there. We infer its existence through its gravitational interactions. But we don't actually know anything. If it is a particle, how does it interact? Is it charged under any forces? Does it interact with the standard model at all? And so these are all the kinds of things that particle physics can say something about. The second question that we can ask is about the baryonic matter, which is made up of things that we think we understand, protons and neutrons, et cetera. But there's a puzzle that we don't know the solution to, and that is why is there more baryonic matter than antibaryons? So as far as we can tell, in terms of a cosmological abundance, there aren't any antibaryons. And this is somewhat surprising from the perspective of the standard model, because the standard model, to a high degree of accuracy, respects the differences between baryons and antibaryons. And so if we start off with a baryon-symmetric universe, then somehow we end up in a baryon-asymmetric universe. And this is something that the standard model doesn't explain. And so even this little sliver that we think we understand, we don't really understand why that's there and why it has the properties that it does. And so these are good motivations for looking at extensions of the standard model. Now, you've probably heard about other conjectured extensions of the standard model. So for instance, there are things that we don't understand, like the electroweak hierarchy, why the Higgs boson mass is so light compared to the Planck scale. We don't understand the flavor structure of the standard model, why the quarks have different masses and what their mixing angles are and all of these kinds of things. The reason why I'm going to focus on these questions instead of those questions, well, there are a few reasons that I'm going to focus on the cosmological questions. So the first of these is that the cosmological questions are known new physics. There's nothing in our current theory of particle physics or gravity that can account for them. Okay? This is in contrast with things like the hierarchy problem, where it's not, the essence of the problem is that there's some tuning, there's some odd adjustments that we have to put in the theory in order to make it work. But there's nothing inherently inconsistent about a tuned standard model. It could just be that the Higgs boson mass has been made artificially light. And so in some sense, those are questions of your philosophical taste. If you think that naturalness is an important principle, then those are really important questions to pursue. If, however, you take to heart some of the recent findings that we've had, that the LHC hasn't really seen any new particles that are associated with natural solutions to the hierarchy problem, we haven't seen any evidence for any explanation behind flavor structure, then maybe those things aren't accessible to us right now. Maybe those guidelines aren't the right guidelines to be pursuing in order to construct new theories. However, these are things that we know are there, and so it's worth trying to figure out an answer to them. The second reason why it's interesting to think about these things is that there are many current and upcoming experiments regarding these phenomena, particularly dark matter, but also some experiments are probing theories of baryogenesis as well. Yes?
So you say known new physics. In the case of dark matter, has it been ruled out that it could just be astrophysical objects?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So there are certain... So today I'll talk a little bit about what the evidence for dark matter is. And for each of those things, you can... For each bit of evidence for dark matter, you can come up with an explanation that is not dark matter for why it is the way it is. But those things don't all work together. So it might be possible that you could construct some kind of crazy sort of sausage grinder kind of solution. But generally speaking, you either need to modify gravity or you need to have some new particle. So, but that's a good question. The other thing is, I guess you're right that there could be some really crazy astrophysical thing that we don't understand, but that's hard to square with the how well it seems astrophysics works for other things that we know about. That's a good question. Okay, so there are lots of upcoming experiments that are looking at these things, and so we could actually have the potential to learn a lot about what dark matter is and what's going on with baryogenesis. And what's nice about experiments for dark matter is that they tend to come cheaper and smaller scale than things like the LHC. The next collider might not be built for 30 years, and it's not that exciting to be thinking about what's happening that far out, or at least to think exclusively about that. So there's lots to do in this area. Another reason is that particle physics plus cosmology has already been shown to be successful in some regard. So it's true that the standard model cannot explain dark matter and it can't explain the baryon antibaryon asymmetry. But if we apply particle physics to the early universe, there are some things it does explain. For instance, you can make predictions about the light element abundances from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and it agrees very well with observations. In fact, it agrees so well that this places very strong constraints on what kind of new particle physics you can add to the standard model so that it doesn't disrupt things like Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Similarly, the fact that there's a cosmic microwave background was a prediction of taking just standard model particles and seeing what happens to them in the early universe. And while we can't explain all the features of the CMB with just the standard model, the gross features are there. So we have some idea that particle physics works the way that we think it does in the early universe. And this has only been further confirmed by this recent BICEP result. If true, it seems like what we learn in quantum field theory really applies to very, very early times and very large energy scales. So it makes a lot of sense to think about these things. And then finally, it's a good chance to learn a lot about particle physics in an applied context. So you're going to have to be learning about all kinds of calculating various scattering rates, scattering cross sections. There are effects of quantum interference that participate in some of these processes. You need to know about cosmology and astrophysics. So it's a nice way of bringing everything together from various aspects of physics. And so these are the reasons why I think it's interesting to focus on these. And hopefully you agree that these are worth looking at. So as a brief outline of what we're going to do for the rest of the course, so in the first week, we're going to do a review of early universe cosmology, thermodynamics, and then see how particle physics predicts various abundances of different species. And then we're going to use this to discuss thermal dark matter, which is dark matter particles that were in thermal equilibrium with the Standard Model at some point in their past. We'll look particularly at a particular kind of dark matter called WIMP dark matter, which has recently been a favored dark matter candidate. Then in the second week, we'll take what we've learned about the properties of dark matter and say, how do we actually look for it? So what are the kinds of experiments that we can do to detect WIMPs? And also, what happens if we perturb away from this WIMP regime? And then we'll also look at some other kinds of dark matter candidates. And then finally, in the last week, we'll take a look at baryogenesis. So how do you go from this matter-antimatter symmetric universe into a matter-antimatter asymmetric universe? So some of the underlying principles of this, and then how you can actually take specific particle physics models and predict what the asymmetry is. And then we're going to connect it in with dark matter through something called asymmetric dark matter, which has been around for a while, but in the past maybe 5 years has picked up in a lot of people's interest because it changes some of the properties of dark matter that you might expect from these other pictures. All right, so are there any questions about this so far? Okay, so let's get right into it. So for today's lecture, we're going to look at an introduction to dark matter. So this is going to be looked at in three topics. The first one is evidence for dark matter. And we're going to take particular interest in what that evidence for dark matter is telling us about what the properties of the dark matter particle have to be. So we're going to look at evidence from cosmology, and then from galaxies and galaxy clusters. So in other words, evidence from the universe as a whole that there's dark matter there, and then also just evidence that that we can see observationally from observations of individual astrophysical objects. Then second, we're going to look at the dark matter hypothesis, which is exactly what we mean by dark matter, what properties it has to satisfy if we're looking for a good particle physics candidate of it. And then some of the challenges for dark matter. So for the first few weeks, we're going to be talking a lot about dark matter. In all fairness, I also want to point out the fact that there are some things that dark matter doesn't predict very well. And so just in the spirit of honesty, it's important to point those things out. And there are also areas of active research where if you're perturbing beyond just the simplest dark matter models, then these things are interesting to look at. Okay. First topic, evidence for dark matter. So our most important cosmological probe of dark matter is the cosmic microwave background, or the CMB. And if you'll remember, the basic idea of the cosmic microwave background is that at temperatures higher than the recombination scale, essentially the energy associated with the binding of electrons to protons, you just have free charged nuclei, you have free charged electrons, and these are all exchanging photons every which way with one another. Okay. And so you have this plasma, which we call the baryon photon plasma, which consists of all of these charged particles that are interacting through photons. Then, over a very short period of time, the temperature of the universe drops below the binding energy associated with hydrogen. And so now you just end up with neutral atoms. Okay? But you had all of these photons that were flying around. They don't actually see anything anymore because everything's neutral. So now your photons just stream out. They don't really interact with anything. And these photons continue to stream, and we can see them today. They form some radiation that has characteristic temperature today of about 2.73 Kelvin. And it's sort of the glow of the Big Bang. And we can use this to study various properties of what was going on in the universe at this particular point in time. And so what happens when you go from this before to after picture? We need to learn a little bit more about what the dynamics were in this early stage. And so because you had this plasma where you had different particles that were interacting with one another, you end up with what's essentially a fluid. And the fluid consists of heavy things, the nuclei, which are interacting through the photons and can be pushed and pulled in various ways. And so you end up with some medium that looks like, you know, baryons. And then there are various forces that try to push them together and also push them apart, which are the various interactions mediated by the photons. So like all fluids, they permit wave propagation. And so we have what are essentially sound waves, where if I take some amount of baryons and I push them a little, then I'm going to jiggle these springs, and I'm going to end up with ripples in this fluid. Okay, and there's some characteristic speed associated with these, which is the speed of sound in the medium. And so what's relevant is what I said, that if there are some things that are perturbing the various elements of this, then you end up with wave propagation. So if all we had in the universe were baryons and photons, then this would be it. But let's say that I have some other particle that's not interacting with the baryons and photons. So suppose we have a decoupled particle. There's nothing to prevent that particle from clumping together. Here, if I try to bring the baryons together, they get repelled. But what I end up with are these local gravitational wells from these decoupled particles that all clump together. So here's some potential well. And then I have this fluid that's all around it. And the baryons are going to be pulled into this potential well. So if I draw it like this, the baryons. But of course, these are all tightly coupled to one another, and so as they come in, they get compressed, which then pushes them back outwards again. And so these little gravitational potential wells are going to induce fluctuations in this background medium. Okay, and the fluctuations are going to depend on the relative amounts that I have of baryons, of the photons, and of these decoupled species, where if I form deeper wells with more baryons, then they're going to get pulled in deeper, and that's going to change the relative amplitude of the compression phase versus the rarefaction phase. So basically, the dynamics of the universe here is completely different depending on if I have different quantities of stuff, of decoupled particles versus baryons versus photons. Now, this is nice. How do we actually see it in the CMB? Well, if I have these waves that are propagating, so I have like a little plane wave here. This is my really bad attempt at a plane wave. And then at a certain point here, neutral atoms form, and all of my oscillations and everything stop. The photons just stream out. And so if I'm sitting here, say, then I'm seeing photons that are streaming from all kinds of different places that are hitting me. Same time. And so as I look in different directions, I'm going to see various parts of maxima and minima on different angular scales. So depending on which direction I'm looking in, I'm going to see either a maximum here or a minimum here. And based on the distance that these photons have traveled since recombination, there's going to be different angular correlations associated with the things being both at a maximum, things being both at a minimum, et cetera. Okay. So having a quantitative understanding of this is beyond the scope of what we're doing. I'm just trying to motivate that that you can actually see what these differences are associated with different amounts of baryons and photons. Okay? So what we do is we take the sky, which is essentially a sphere to us, and we say, well, how do I characterize things on a sphere? I can do a decomposition into spherical harmonics. And so I essentially say, well, if I have a maximum, this corresponds to more pressure. And we know that for a gas, more pressure means a higher temperature, slightly higher temperature. And if I'm in a minimum, there's less pressure, and so I'm at a slightly lower temperature. What I'm going to see at different angles are different temperatures. And that's, in fact, what we see in the CMB. If I look at the full sky map, then I see lots of different specks, which are little fluctuations of hot patches and cold patches. And if we take those hot and cold patches and say, well, are there any angular connections between them, then we can look for the imprint of these waves in the cosmic microwave background. Okay, and what we end up with is something that looks like this. So after we decompose into spherical harmonics, what we're essentially looking for is, are there certain characteristic angles that give us more connections in the different temperatures? So a peak represents there being, say, you know, two spots associated with high temperature for, with respect to one another. And indeed, what we see is, so this is L, which is, I mean, if you think about these in terms of like the hydrogen atom, this is like the quantum number that characterizes, you know, whether it's a sphere versus the dumbbell versus various other rings. So these are characterizing smaller and smaller angular scales as you go up to higher L. And this is essentially the sort of power in each L, or the amount of connections that there are on those angular scales. It's formally defined in terms of some coefficient here. What we see is that it starts out flat, and then you have a peak, and then you have a trough, and then you have a peak, and you have a trough, and a peak. Okay. So what this is telling us is that these correlations associated with wave propagation are actually there. You can actually see the sound waves in the CMB. And they tell us different things about how these photons propagated. And in general, doing this analysis is very complicated. But by analyzing this structure and doing a fit to it, I can figure out what the relative composition of baryons to photons to decoupled matter to dark energy, or to the cosmological constant. Okay, and so what we find is that I can write out the parameters here. So I define this omega is of some type I, is the energy density in that species I over what we call the critical density. This critical density, if omega is equal to 1, so rho is equal to rho critical, then the universe is flat. There's no curvature. And in the next lecture, we'll see a little bit more what that means. Okay, so what this is essentially telling me is what fraction of stuff I have in each kind of matter. So omega baryon tells me the fraction of baryons. For our universe, the sum of these omegas is about 1, to a very high degree of accuracy, to 0.several%. So if I have omega of 0.7, it means 70% of the stuff is in that particular species. So when I do this analysis, I find that the amount of energy density that's in the cosmological constant, it's about 0.7. So it's actually 0.68, but using the latest update. And my omega matter is about 0.32. So this means that 32% of the energy in the universe is in matter. And the amount of energy I have in baryons is about 0.05. And the way I can tell these apart is because the baryonic matter and the total matter behave differently. The total matter leads to the clumping in these wells, and the baryonic matter tells me the relative strengths of different parts of the oscillation. And so by looking at this, you see right away that omega matter is not equal to omega baryons. And this is true when we look at the entire universe all at once in a snapshot. And so we cannot, so I think this partly answers your question, Karen, about whether there could be some just astrophysical thing we're not understanding. If it's still just made of baryons that we're not seeing today, then when we look at the CMB, all of these things were sort of on a more equal footing. And so you'd see omega baryon is equal to omega matter. Yes?
The M and the lambda do.
Sorry. Right, because omega matter is equal to omega baryon plus something. Yeah. So these two things add up to one. Sorry, I should have clarified. So baryons are a type of matter. Okay. So, and this can be confirmed by other observations. So we can determine the value of omega baryon from the CMB. We can also determine the value of omega baryon from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and they're in good agreement with one another. So what we find is that the CMB is telling us unequivocally that there has to be something else in the early universe in order to explain the pattern that we see. So often you'll see, you know, the data points of the CMB, and there's some best fit line that's associated with lambda CDM. And the error bars are typically so small that you can't even see them. That's how well these things are measured. And so even if you tweak one of these parameters by 1%, it typically makes the curve excluded. So this is very strong evidence for the existence that there's something else going on than just baryonic matter. And like I said, this is not something that can be explained away by, well, this part of the universe that we're looking at just happens to have a little bit more, a little bit less. This is something that is qualitatively independent of that. Okay, so are there any questions about dark matter from the CMB? Okay. Oh, now I have to figure out how to make the boards work. Okay. Yes. That's right, yeah. So, I'm being a little bit sloppy in my notation. So, omega is typically the sum of omega in a cosmological constant plus omega matter plus omega radiation. The amount of energy in radiation is quite small relative to the amount of energy in everything else. So, okay, so that's cosmology. What about other places that we can look for dark matter? So it turns out that this isn't just some kind of ethereal thing that's showing up in some weird spectrum that we're, you know, maybe we just don't understand what's going on with the CMB. But if we actually look at astrophysical objects, we also infer the existence of some kind of new matter that is not visible. And this is actually how dark matter was first, I mean, I use the word discovered somewhat loosely, but it was first conjectured to explain various anomalies in the studies of the kinematics of galaxies and galaxy clusters. So what we want to do here is we can actually see, in some sense, dark matter, and or rather, we can infer its existence through its action on other particles. So the clearest way of seeing this is if we look at spiral galaxies. So these are typically rotating. And they have a structure where there's a bulge in the middle, and then there's sort of a flat disk that surrounds it that's very thin. So if we look at it straight on, what we see is something that looks like this, and then there's this bulge in the middle. Okay, so I'm going to call this the center of the galaxy, and I'm going to call this distance r, which runs from the center of the galaxy out. So these things are spinning, and the way that I can tell that they're spinning is that when they're rotating, I'm going to have some characteristic. So for instance, this part of the galaxy is going to be rotating out of the board, and this part of the galaxy is going to be rotating into the board. So there is going to be a relative velocity between these two things. And we know that when things have a relative velocity with us, that there's a Doppler shift. So light from the galaxy is Doppler shifted. And I can look at the Doppler shift, how it changes as I move out along the radius. And from this, I can construct essentially a local linear velocity as a function of the radius. So how fast is something, a distance r, moving? And then on the other side, of course, it's moving in the opposite direction. Okay? Now, we know from high school mechanics that when you have bodies that are moving under gravity, that the kinetic energy is going to be related to the potential. There's the gravitational potential gives you an acceleration, which causes rotation. And so from using Newton's equation or Poisson's equation, which is a more sophisticated version of that, I can relate the velocity through Newton's constant to the mass over r squared. So this is the mass enclosed at radius r. Oops. And so there should be this relationship between the observed mass in the galaxy and the observed v. So these come from the Doppler shift that I just explained. Now, how do I determine the amount of mass that's enclosed by a radius r? Well, I don't actually have a way of determining the mass, but I can estimate it. I can look at how much light is coming from it. I can do various analyses on that, and I can do an estimate of the mass based on the total luminous matter that's there. So, so we estimate by looking at stars, gas, etc. And we know that the stars, gas, etc. are confined to this plane and largely concentrated in the central region, and then they fall off as we go out. And so what I can do is I can take my observations and say, well, given what I know about the luminous mass, I can make a prediction about what the velocity looks like just from this equation. And it looks something like this. There's a steep peak, and then it falls off. Okay? And that's just from the fact that you're enclosing less and less mass as you go out. So this is predicted by luminous matter. And then I can look at my Doppler shift and say, well, what do I actually see? And so it follows it very closely here, and then it flattens out. So this is sort of weird, because my formula is saying, I should be able to relate these things directly. It looks like there's more mass in here than I am predicting just from the luminous matter. Okay? And that's causing these things to rotate faster. So there are a few conclusions I can draw from this. So possible conclusions. It could be that gravity is wrong. So if my Newtonian picture is wrong, then this equation, I can just cross it out. And I say that gravity has to be adapted to fit this. But if I don't want to do away with gravity, and there are good reasons why you don't want to mess around with gravity, is that there's some new invisible matter. And this invisible matter has to extend far beyond the visible matter. And we can estimate, yes?
How confident are we at relating luminosity to mass?
So I'm not an astrophysicist, so I could only pass on the answer that they give me. But I think it's very well, because we have some standard candles that they use that are, So all I could say is that this is known very well. I'm not sure exactly the techniques that are used. And I think that the techniques are used differently depending on the redshift and whether it's mostly gas or mostly stars. But I can look into that. But I'm pretty sure that that is not a possible explanation. That was something that was not realized. So this kind of argument was first applied in the 1930s, and people just thought, okay, this person's totally crazy. There's probably something else that's going on. But I think every observation since then has racked up to say, this is the way it is. You get it from looking at galaxy clusters. You get it from looking at all kinds of things. So, Yes. Right, okay, so if I want to see what the mass distribution to give me a velocity that's independent of r, then I can just solve for v, so I get v squared is equal to g m of r over r. Okay, so this is for a flat, or so if this is a flat curve, it means that m of r has to be proportional to r, and if we assume that m of r is the integral over some density, then we see that rho has to go like r to the minus 2. Okay, so what this is implying is that there's some spherical distribution of something that's falling off like r minus 2 that's keeping these rotation curves flat. And they stay flat very, very far out. So maybe one other answer to your question is that these extend out so far that we don't actually see any visible matter out on the end of it. And so so I just don't think that it's possible that it could account for that. Okay, so once again, we've had something thrown at us, which is that there seems to be something more than is accounted for just from what you would expect from baryons, which is hot gas and stars, et cetera. So we also see dark matter on local scales. So in other words, we see clumps of it, which is exactly the same thing that's driving this phenomenon here. Here we're seeing very small clumps that are influencing the evolution of the entire universe. Here, after we've evolved to much later times, we're seeing much bigger clumps of dark matter. But basically, it's the same phenomenon that's going on. And then there's an even more striking picture, which is if we zoom out and look at galaxy clusters. There's a very special arrangement that we've observed astrophysically, which is called the bullet cluster. And the bullet cluster is significant because we actually can see the separation between the sort of dark or non-luminous matter, or invisible, whatever you want to call it, and visible matter. So here you could say, well, these things are centered on the same thing. Maybe we're just measuring things wrong. But here we see something very different. So the picture of the bullet cluster, we have two galaxy clusters. And at initial times, of course, we don't actually see the initial times, but this is what we can infer. These galaxy clusters were headed straight for one another. And they collide. Okay. So now what we're actually seeing is this, where this galaxy cluster over here has passed through the other one. Okay. So the question is, what happened during this collision? And there are various ways that we can study the amount of matter. So how can we So one thing that we can do is, once again, we can look at X-ray emissions from the hot gases that are interacting with each other and other signs of visible matter. The other thing that we can do is we can actually use gravitational lensing. The fact that light from other galaxy clusters that are behind these galaxy clusters get bent around them. And there are various signatures that are associated with that. There are these arcs that show up for strong gravitational lensing, and there are other more subtle features that you can disentangle. What you find is that if you look at the visible matter, which we'll denote by this blue arrow, what you see is something that looks like this. And if I look at my gravitational lensing data, it tells me that my matter is predominantly out here. So the gravitational lensing, GR tells us that any curvature of space deflects light. And so this is a measure of the total matter, whereas this blue is a measure of the visible matter. So what we see is that there's actually a separation between the invisible and the visible components of the matter. And how did this happen? Well, when these things collided with each other, the visible matter, as we see, interacts electromagnetically. That's why it's giving off light for us to see. So these clouds of gas interact with each other, and they partially slow each other down. So while they still pass through each other, there's some inertial drag on them. And it confines them to this middle section here. However, if we look at the lensing data, we see that the bulk of the matter just kept going as if there was nothing there. So what this tells us is that yet again, there's something indicating that there's something more going on. This is something that modifying gravity has a very hard time explaining, because you can't explain why your gravity theory is showing a different distribution than what your like different spatial position associated with your matter. And this is also telling us that whatever this is can't interact the same way that the visible matter does, because if it did, it also would have got stuck in the middle. So this tells us that, once again, there's dark matter, and the dark matter can't interact too much. Okay. So there are many other examples that give evidence for dark matter. I'm not going to go through all of them. But I hope that this sampling tells you that no matter where we look, we tend to see dark matter, astrophysically and cosmologically, and that it's over a very wide range of scales. So the CMB is a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. This is going on 14 billion years after the Big Bang. So there's something very interesting going on. And we want to see what particle physics has to say about this. So this brings us to our second point, which is the dark matter hypothesis. I should have just moved. Okay, so if we're going to take the route that we keep GR intact and we're not going to do anything crazy with gravity, we see that there has to be at least one new kind of particle. And we want it to satisfy the properties from the various detection methods that we've seen. So first off, it's worth pointing out that we've only seen dark matter via gravity. So if we look at this CMB picture, the reason why we can infer the existence of matter is that it creates these deep gravitational potential wells. If we look at the galaxy curves, again, it's the fact that there's this extra matter that's interacting gravitationally. Similarly here, it's affecting gravitational lensing. So these things don't tell us anything definitive about what the properties have to be. They more tell us what the properties can't be. So that's helpful in ruling out some possibilities, but it also leaves a very wide range of possibilities open. So the first thing that property that it has to have is it has to be non-luminous. It shouldn't give off light. If it interacts with light too much, then it becomes part of this coupled plasma. Then we see it in observations of galaxies and galaxy clusters, et cetera. And what this means practically is that it can't interact with the U1 electromagnetic force or the SU3 color force. You can say, well, the SU3 color force doesn't actually interact with light directly. But it turns out that a lot of strongly charged particles do interact with light. And so because this interaction is so strong, you typically tend to generate other charged particles that you could see. In particular, pions that you produce just generally in color object scattering, neutral pions, for instance, can decay to two photons. So you can convert to say energy and dark matter into pions, which decay into photons. And so you really can't have these things interacting very strongly with either of these forces. So the second thing it has to do, it has to be feebly interacting, or I should say less than feebly interacting with itself and with the visible particles. So even if I don't let it interact with light, but if it interacts too much with itself, then this bullet cluster doesn't work. I wouldn't have these dark matter halos just passing through each other, then they would get stuck in the middle as well. And similarly, if they interact too strongly with visible particles, then you induce electromagnetic effects. Yes?
Before the bullet cluster evidence, how do we know the dark matter does not interact strongly with itself?
We didn't really.
Okay.
That's the strongest
I had. There wouldn't have been any changes to the CMB?
I don't think so. No. The important thing is that it is decoupled from the baryons. That's the key point. Okay. And I should say, when I say feebly, I mean that these things are somewhat relative terms. You can actually have a somewhat strong interaction between dark matter. Basically, you have to make sure you don't violate the constraints from the bullet cluster. All right. It has to be a long-lived particle. It has to have time bigger than 14 billion years. Because if it's a particle that can decay, then if it decayed away, then you might be okay from the CMB's time frame, but you're not okay for all of these other things. Okay. Now, it can decay if its time scale is about the length of the universe. Okay, and that's actually one of the ways that we can look for dark matter. But I'll leave that for later. And then the last point, which is something that didn't really get covered in the examples that I chose, but I'm just going to say it, is that it has to be non-relativistic at the time of structure formation, meaning the prototypes of galaxies. So it turns out another piece of evidence for dark matter is if you just take the standard model particles and do a simulation of them and say, how do they clump together, it just doesn't form anything that looks like what we see. You kind of need the dark matter backbone around which galaxies, et cetera, form. And the only way that this works is if they're moving slow enough that they get dragged in gravitationally. So if it's moving too fast, then the escape velocity for these little perturbations is too high and things just kind of stream out. So these are the properties that our dark matter particles have to satisfy. And these just follow from the various observations that we've had. So we can now go through all of the standard model particles and see, well, do any of them satisfy these criteria? So we'll start by ruling out any particle that has EM or color charge. And that leaves us with essentially three. We have a photon, we have a Z boson, and we have neutrinos. Okay. The photon, it's relativistic now. It's massless. And so it fails because of this condition D. The Z boson satisfies all the other conditions except it's not long-lived. It decays on timescales of something like 10 to the minus 15 seconds or something. So this is also not good. And then we're left with neutrinos, which are similarly almost massless. So these are also relativistic, so they fail condition D. It also turns out that given what we know about neutrinos now, there just aren't enough of them to explain dark matter. Okay, so that was fast. We know right away that the standard model cannot account for all of these observations. So we need something new. And basically the next few weeks are going to be devoted to what this new particle could be, what its interactions have to be in order to explain all the observations, and basically providing all of these connections between particle physics, cosmology, and astrophysics. Okay, so are there any questions about this so far? Yes.
Definitely more philosophical, but why does it have to be a particle? Like, why can't we say the particles? The particle way of thinking about things just doesn't apply to astrophysical scales. Like, I mean, we see the Unruh effect and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, so it's possible that that could be true. But again, I think that part of the motivation behind this is that we know that, for instance, that the particle physics picture works at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, because I can just go and make predictions about the light element abundances. And that's before all of this. And so it's true that it, in some sense, is a conjecture. But as we'll see, it's actually really easy to come up with particles that satisfy this. So in the absence of any more information, that seems to make the most sense. But you could certainly think of more exotic possibilities. Yes, Ryan?
Can this be explained with like a modified, like Brodsky theory of gravity? Is that possible?
So I don't think you can explain it with a Brodsky theory. So you need to, there's, I mean, I'll talk about it for a few minutes, but there's this modified Newtonian dynamics, which isn't really a theory of gravity. It's more just a phenomenological scaling modification to the gravitational laws that you have to do. And that can satisfy some of these conditions. It's hard for it to explain the bullet cluster. It doesn't really explain some of the CMB observations. And the problem with a lot of these things is that in the absence of a complete UV consistent theory, I can explain things that I'm seeing now, but if I want to scale back to the early universe, people say, oh, I don't know what was going on in the early universe. I'll just, maybe the gravity law was different then, and so it is consistent with the CMB or something. So I think the onus is on people who are doing modified gravity to show that you don't mess up any of the other things that we know very well. But in principle, it's also possible because we are only seeing it from gravity. Okay, so in the next 10 minutes before we go, I want to talk about some of the challenges. Wait. Some of the challenges to gravity. Sorry, not to gravity, to dark matter. And that's just in the spirit of being honest about, you know, we've talked all about the successes that dark matter can do, but it doesn't work out 100%. There are some things that have some conflict with observations. Some of these things are more consistent with a modified gravity than they are with dark matter. So, if you can find a way of weaving them all together, then you should come and talk to me. We get a Nobel Prize. So, but it's just to keep on your radar, what are some of the things we could be thinking about? And some of the things that I'm going to mention also, you don't necessarily have to modify gravity, but they could infer the existence of interactions between dark matter or some non-trivial physics, which is interesting from the perspective of dark matter theory. Okay, so challenges to dark matter. One of these is in structure formation. So basically, the formation of galaxies and galaxy clusters. So as I said, it works mostly well. Other people do them. These things called n-body simulations, where I basically take a whole bunch of dark matter particles, and I let them interact gravitationally and just see how they clump and form. This then gives me a prediction of what the universe should look like in terms of how galaxies are arranged, what their typical distances are, et cetera. And this works pretty well, okay? Except there are two particular features that are not well reproduced by the n-body simulations. So two features not reproduced. So the first one is called the cusp core problem, and the second one there are a bunch of things that are under the heading of small scale structure. What the cusp core problem is, if I take these n-body simulations and see how does dark matter clump together, then I look at my typical galaxy, and I can look at the distance from the center and the mass density, and my simulation tells me that it should look something like this, which isn't very surprising. I have some slow-moving things that are interacting gravitationally, and they all clump together in the middle, essentially. Now, when we actually look at the data, what we see is that it's well described here, and then right in this inner region, it flattens out. Okay. So this is what we call a cusp. This is what we call a core. And simulations give us the cusp, and observations tell us that there seems to be a core. Okay. So the other thing that it seems not to get right is if we look at the formation of large galaxies, what actually happens is that dark matter first clumps into little, smaller kind of sub-galaxies, we call them sub-halos, and then those in turn subsequently clump together into larger galaxies. So a large galaxy is actually made up of lots of little things of various sizes. And so what I can do is I can say, well, I want to count the number of objects of a certain mass. So here's the mass of the object, and here's the number. And my predictions look something like this. Again, that on small scales, things form structure quite easily, and then they then clump together into fewer numbers of larger galaxies. Again, the actual observation is something that looks kind of like this. So this is simulation. This is actual. So there are a few possible reasons for this. One of them is that these n-body simulations are quite primitive. I mean, I think that some of them are on the order of 100,000 solar masses per particle in the simulation. So maybe there is just something that you're messing up in terms of doing your simulation. So for instance, only recently are these simulations beginning to incorporate the effects of baryons. Before, they used to be dark matter only. And so maybe in the central region of the galaxy, where you have lots of baryons there, they're modifying the dynamics of the dark matter. So we know that there are things like supernovae that can eject dark matter from the center. So there are various feedback effects. So this could just be a problem with simulations. They could be due to some observational limitation. Or they could be telling us that dark matter isn't quite like the hypothesis says. So maybe there is some small amount of interaction which causes the dark matter to thermalize a little bit, and for instance, instead of just having everything clump directly in the middle, you end up with some characteristic kinetic energy in the middle that causes a flattening of the density. Or maybe it's not quite non-relativistic, and so when you look at very small scales, the dark matter doesn't actually form there. It sort of streams out of these very small regions. So this motivates things like self-interacting dark matter, subject, of course, to the bullet cluster constraints and other constraints that we have, but you can turn on some small interaction, or what we call warm dark matter, which is that if it's slightly relativistic at structure formation. And so these things might be a clue that there are some interesting particle physics kinds of things that are going on with dark matter. It's not just some boring particle that falls into a potential well. But maybe these are suggesting that there's actually something interesting we can see. Okay. Now, the second thing, which I don't really have much time, but I'll say very quickly, is perhaps a little bit more troubling. It's called the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation. And so what we do for this is we look at so-called low surface brightness galaxies. So the low surface brightness part means there's very little visible matter. And so these are dark matter dominated galaxies. These are galaxies with lots of dark matter and very little visible matter. And so we expect all of the dynamics to be determined by the dark matter. However, if I do something silly, like I take, so you can also construct rotation curves like this V of R, like we were talking about earlier. And this is the maximum velocity for the cluster. So this is some measure of, sorry, the galaxy. This is some measure of how the matter is responding, like the visible matter is responding to whatever matter is in the center of the galaxy. And then we plot it versus the amount of visible matter. So this velocity we expect to be sensitive to the total matter. And we expect this to be proportional to the visible matter. And all the things that we've looked at so far tell us, oh, well, there's more matter than just visible matter. And particularly here, where it's dark matter dominated, we expect it, you know, that there should not be a very clear relationship between these two things, that there's more matter than just that. But it turns out that when we plot these things, they actually form a very clear relationship. So in these particular kinds of galaxies, there's actually a very strong correlation between the total matter and the visible matter. And this is weird because you're in a dark matter dominated galaxy. So there's something funny going on here. And I don't think that it's totally understood what's going on well. Some people wave their hands and say, well, you know, our simulations aren't quite correct and we're not including effects. But if there's some problem with your simulation, you would expect to see not much structure. But instead, you see quite a bit of structure here. Now, there are some people that say that this is evidence that cold dark matter is wrong, and that you can explain this in a modified gravity framework. And in fact, the same modified gravity framework that gives you the rotation curves also gives you this. But of course, there are all kinds of other evidence we have, for instance, from the CMB, from the bullet cluster, that can't be accommodated by this. So I don't have a very good answer for this. For the rest of the course, we're going to assume that there's something that we don't understand that it can explain this relationship. And indeed, recent simulations that include baryons seem to give you something that's a little bit closer to that. But you know, there are people that do modified gravity here, so I thought I would at least say that, you know, it's not a totally crazy thing, that there are some things that cold dark matter doesn't quite explain. But for the rest of the class, we're going to assume that the dark matter is the way to go, and tomorrow we'll start looking at the role of dark matter in early universe cosmology.
Does modified gravity?
Yes. Yeah. So the reason is that so basically what MOND is, so if people need to go, you can go. I don't want to keep everyone here while I talk about MOND. But what MOND says is, so we had this relationship, you know, A is equal to V squared over R, which is equal to GM over R. Okay, and so this is, so this is what told us that in order for to have a flat rotation curve, that this m of r had to go like r. But if instead I say, well, actually this is wrong on some scales, that it's actually something like f goes like n a squared over a zero for small accelerations. So this a zero is like 10 to the minus 10. Meters per second squared or something. It's some very, very tiny acceleration. So if I just postulate that gravity acts differently on things that are accelerating slowly, then if you solve this, you actually find a flat rotation curve. The reason is that you have this extra power of a, and your factors of r cancel. You know, a squared goes like 1 over r squared. So, right, so a squared goes like v squared over r squared. This goes like a naught Gm over r squared. So what I end up with is this relationship that v goes like the fourth root of a naught Gm. Okay? So this automatically predicts a fourth power relationship between mass and velocity. Now the problem with this is that this isn't actually a theory, right? This is just a phenomenological scaling relationship. And so if you actually try to say, well, is there something, you know, the universe looks like general relativity on larger accelerations, it turns out you can do it if you add in a whole bunch of other things, but it's unclear whether that's a consistent theory of gravity and what the implications are for cosmology and so on. So MOND actually predicts this, and this is what MOND supporters say are, you know, this is a really big deal. But of course, to focus on this to ignore everything else, I think, is a little bit naive. So, yeah. Are there any other questions? Okay, we'll see you tomorrow then.